The next case was presented by Dr. Friedland to Dr. Roach.
I had a patient, actually, it was an interesting patient, Tom Keene's, who he did a radical prostatectomy on when he was a chief resident at the VA hospital at Duke. At the time of surgery, the patient was 65, and it was a T3A positive margin Gleason 7. It was undetectable PSA for about 5 years, and now started rising about 5 years out when he was about 70, slowly rising, and is now up to, at age 75, his PSA is now up to 1, with about a 2-year doubling time. And we, being Tom primarily, has been watching it, and you can see it's a steady 2-year doubling time over the last 6 years. One of the problems is we see these men with initially a 2-year doubling time, and then after a while it moves to a year and a half, and then it kind of moves to a year, and then maybe a 6-month doubling time. This guy has been pretty steady at a 2-year doubling time. So he's now 75, developing some other problems, reasonably healthy, but I mean some other medical problems coming up. And, you know, he's asking, should I have radiation therapy or not?
How's he been about not being on treatment?
He's a little anxious about it, but he seems to be actually tolerating it reasonably well. I think he's more, when I saw him, because Tom sent him to me as a second opinion, was he was anxious to know, should he have radiation or should he not? Because he was about to start some experimental treatment for his arthritis, which is his main concern, and didn't want the radiation, if he was going to have it, to interfere or delay with that. So that he was really anxious about the arthritis. Prostate cancer didn't seem to be as great of a concern.
Actually, I have two patients like that under treatment now who had their surgeries done sometime in the distant past by very good surgeons, and they've had slowly rising PSAs for a number of years, and both of them have PSAs that are around 1. One of them actually has a twin brother who had the same thing, and they were both fearful of having radiation. So I radiated his twin brother, and his twin brother did well, so now he's decided that now he wants to have his radiation done. The other gentleman was very surprised. One thing that a lot of patients don't seem to be told is that they may recur. So the second patient had a radical prostatectomy and was just totally shocked that they could recur. The thought never crossed his mind. He thought his prostate was gone. He would not have to worry about this particular medical problem again. What I did is I shared with him the Stevenson data from the nomogram, or the recent publication, which divides outcome based on the PSA at the time the patient is radiated. And I showed him that the higher the PSA was, the higher the failure rate. And he looked where his PSA was going and decided, you know, I don't really want to get to that place where my control rate is lower. So he decided to proceed with radiation. The interesting thing is that we have for a number of years been using a combination of hormone therapy and radiation, hormone therapy immediately before in these post-op patients. And now there are, I think, at least 3 good studies that suggest that maybe it's the right thing to do. So one of them is the Memorial data by Katz et al., where they looked at patients who were failing, and those patients who had adverse pathologic features did better if they got neoadjuvant hormone therapy.
By better, you mean better PSA
better
control?
Better PSA control. There's actually a study from Stanford that there's a trend for survival. In the Stanford study, they had about 100 patients, and they had 6 months of hormones for radiation versus none. And even more recently, there's a paper from Stanford suggesting that neoadjuvant hormone with whole pelvic radiotherapy results in a substantial improvement in PSA control rate in the salvage setting, which we have been doing for a number of years. So actually, when I give hormones and radiation, I usually will radiate the pelvic nodes as well. The other important thing that we do is that we mark, the first thing I do if a patient comes to me with a rising PSA after prostatectomy is I get an ultrasound. And very few people do that. Most people figure the standard of care is just to radiate them. There was an earlier paper from Stanford by Connolly et al., which basically reflected the work of Dr. Shen O'Hara, who went back and biopsied all these patients with rising PSAs after prostatectomy. And about 50% of the patients had positive biopsies. But in the patients who had positive biopsies, 90% of them had something that he saw on ultrasound, a hypochloric area or asymmetry or something that shouldn't be there. And so what we do is we mark that area with gold marker seeds. And when we do the radiation, we compensate for setup error and organ movement. It turns out that we did a number of studies which showed that part of the reason that some men may fail salvage radiation is that the field, you're trying to spare the rectum and you're trying to spare the penis and you're trying to spare, you know, bowel. And so some people will be using small fields and they'll be using 3D or IMRT, and they may be missing the nodule because there's setup error on a daily basis. And the position of that nodule can be variable depending upon bladder filling and rectal filling. And so we actually published a paper a few months ago where we showed that about a third of the time we would have had treatment errors of more than 5 millimeters if we had not been using online imaging to correct for setup error and organ movement. So I think that this is part of the problem. And then the other problem is I don't think people have been giving adequate doses in the salvage setting. So I think the data is beginning to accumulate. And certainly you can extrapolate from the definitive setting, neoadjuvant hormone therapy. There's got to be a dose response because some of these men have PSAs. Remember, they don't have a prostate, so all that PSA, so they have gross disease in many cases. And I don't think that the doses may be adequate if 6,000, 6,400, so I tend to give around 7,000, and then use targeting to make sure that you actually hit the spot, which usually corresponds at least somewhere around the anastomosis for those patients.
It's interesting because in terms of the ultrasound, that's kind of a new concept to me, and that's very interesting, and it certainly makes sense. I think what urologists maybe 5 years, 10 years ago used to be doing was biopsies in the anastomosis. And actually, there was a great paper from your institution with Teresa Cuppy as first author basically showing if you had a positive biopsy of the anastomosis or a negative, it didn't predict whether you would respond to salvage radiation. So I think that article, and there were other ones like it, kind of we as a community stopped doing that.
But the thing about that study is we weren't using gold marker seeds to guide the therapy at that point.
Right.
So in fact, part of the reason I decided to start doing it is I had a patient who had a nodule. We didn't have the online imaging system that we have now, but we would just take films. And with radiation oncologists, you take a port film once a week. So the patient was being treated at another hospital, so he had his last treatment. They took a port film, and it showed that the accuracy, they didn't have as good a coverage of that recurrence as I would have liked. He had a biopsy-proven recurrence with a gold seed in it, and the therapist treated, you know, they ported him. So then I thought about, well, maybe we're missing some of these. So I had a patient, the first patient when we got our new system was an African-American gentleman came in, had had a radical prostatectomy, rising PSA. His PSA was around 0.4, had a biopsy-proven nodule. So I had Dr. Shinahara put a gold seed above it and below it. He started his treatment. Well, I looked at his image. Actually, the therapist called me and said, I thought you said he had gold seeds. And I said, he does. And they said, we don't see it in the field. So I said, well, move the field back 5 millimeters. They moved it back. I started to see the edge of the seed. I said, move it back another 5 millimeters. And in fact, the first 3 treatments, I think his tumor was missed. So at the end of his treatment, I added a sort of a postage stamp field just to where that nodule was. So if you look at his chart, it says that he got 8,000 something. But the boost area was very small, limited to that. His continence is fine. His PSA is less than 0.02. His testosterone is normal. And he's out 5 years. In fact, I think I saw him yesterday. So the bottom line is that targeting that recurrence is not as simple as people think it is. And I think that there are a lot of patients who may fail because they didn't have their recurrence adequately treated.
Are you seeing better control rates? I mean, have you been able to compare your more recent patients to the historical patients?
We haven't done that analysis yet. So we probably have in our data set around 250 post-op patients that we have collected. And the ones with gold seeds, we've only been doing that for about 6 years. So it's starting to, but the other problem is that we start to use them in everybody, so we can compare a historical group versus this group.
Right.
And I think if we do that, we're going to have to use a definition of failure that's not going to be so time-sensitive. So we can't use anything like the ASTRO definition, which raises a point. One of the common things that we see is, you know, I had a patient who I just saw the other day. He happened to be a patient who had a Gleason 7, had a PSA of around 15. I treated him with hormones and external beam. I was going to.
How old is he?
He was about 65. I was going to treat him with an implant, and he really didn't want an implant. So he sort of.
Why not?
Some people just don't want to have radioactive seeds put in them. I'm not sure. I can't remember exactly what his rationale was, but you know, he's a minority. Most of the men that have adverse features, I tend to do an implant boost of some sort. But anyway, he sort of talked me out of it, and his PSA had been fine. And then he didn't get one for a while, so he came in. So I obtained the PSA the day that he was seen in clinic. And then 3 months later, he came back, and we had a very quick visit, and he was feeling fine. And after he left, I became aware of the fact that his PSA had bounced up to 2 point something from the previous visit. Actually, before he left, I became aware we got another PSA, and it was down. So it raises the question about what to do, how to deal with PSAs in patients with definitive radiotherapy who have been on hormone therapy, how to interpret those PSAs. And I think that one of the important changes in our attitude toward PSAs after radiotherapy is the development of a new consensus definition. We no longer recommend the ASTRO definition for PSA failure after radiotherapy. We now use something called the Phoenix definition.
I had one question in terms of calculating PSA doubling time.
Okay.
From an external source, it seems like there's a debate within the radiation oncology world whether you should take the nadir value out when you calculate the doubling times, meaning if a patient goes nadir's at 0.5 and then goes to 1 and now is at 1.5. So should you subtract the nadir from all those values and calculate doubling time, which is the way D'Amico did it in one of his big papers,
right,
or just take all the values at face value, which is probably the more typical way.
Right. I don't know what you should do. If you're doing a study where you're comparing external beam radiation to radical patients, as Anthony did, I think that's a reasonable strategy because you want to have some comparability in terms of what the numbers are. Mm-hmm. In managing a patient in real life, you eyeball the numbers sort of like pornography. You know it when you see it. If you see a patient whose PSA is going up, I don't even calculate their doubling time. I may look at a number of values and say, how long did it take for his PSA to double? As a, just a, you know, his PSA was 8 and 3 months later it was 16. Well, you know, his doubling time is 3 months. I mean, so I think that for now your question, because you do a lot of research and you publish on PSA doubling time, and for the purposes of designing a randomized trial, you need a consistent way of doing it. I don't think that we have enough data to know what to do with that information. But I do have another interesting case.